This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listened to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Welcome back to another Shade of Blue story here on The Felon File. Thank you, Victoria, for setting us up, getting us running, as well as running Control Board for us. We're coming to you once more, recorded, of course, from the backwoods of a mountain in western North Carolina, where I can look out the window, and it is pouring the rain. But we do still appreciate everyone for listening in. Our listener stats are still going up, especially as far as our international listeners go. Canada, Australia, Great Britain being the top runners. If you're listening to us from some other place other than the United States, again, thank you for tuning in. And if you can, no matter where you're listening from, go grab a friend to listen with you, and or at least pass on the link to the website or this particular podcast. We'd love to let other people hear it. If you like music and haven't heard it, the song Walking in Memphis is a must-be-listened-to song. Memphis is a beautiful city in the state of Tennessee, not too terribly far from where we are right now. It is situated along the Mississippi River, has a population of about 633,000, according to the census in 2020. Memphis has the second largest population in Tennessee after Nashville. The first European explorer to visit this area was, of course, Hernando de Soto in 1541. Now, 1819 was when modern Memphis, Tennessee was founded. Was part of the United States territory. John Overton, James Winchester, and Andrew Jackson founded the city. Today's city is famous for Beale Street, the University of Memphis, Graceland, and the Memphis Pyramid. The city's history in the 1870s included a series of yellow fever epidemics that devastated the city, really. The disease was carried by river passengers traveling up and down the Mississippi River and having layovers and stops there in Memphis. During the yellow fever epidemic of 1878, more than 5,000 people were reported to have died due to the disease, and they called it yellowjack at the time. The epidemic in the city of about 40,000 is one of the most traumatic and severe that have occurred in urban United States history. Till recently. And of course, Memphis is known for the good stuff too. There is some great food to be found in Memphis. Excellent restaurants. There's a couple of fantastic breweries there. If you get a chance to visit Memphis, highly recommend it. Memphis, also like most locations in the world, has a dark side, or has had the dark times. For example, the people's grocery lynching that occurred in March of 1892 when African-American grocery store owner Thomas Moses and his two workers, Will Stewart and Calvin McDowell, they were lynched by a white mob while they were in police custody. The store was located just outside of Memphis in a neighborhood called The Curve. Opened in 1889, the People's Grocery was a kind of a co-op venture run along corporate lines that was owned by 11 prominent African-American businessmen. Journalist Ida Wells of Memphis investigated the lynchings, as one of her friends was one of the men that was killed. She demonstrated that these and other lynchings were more often due to economic and social competition than they were to actual any criminal offenses that were committed by the African American men. Unfortunately, her findings were thought to be too controversial. They aroused so much anger that she kind of was forced to flee the city. Not kind of, she did have to flee the city. Well, that's another podcast for another day. I'm still researching those incidents and the documentation, and it's quite interesting and quite sad. But today's Shade of Blue story is about something unusual that occurred a little before 3 o'clock on the afternoon of September 9th, 1886. Now, in police work, unusual is usually the norm. That you talk to any cop and they'll tell you the same thing. This day in question, a man ran into the Memphis, Tennessee City Police Station, telling the police captain, Captain Hackett, quote, "I have just killed a man and I want to give myself up." Well, not to be knocked off his feet, they took down the information, but the captain locked the guy up in a cell. Either the man was telling the truth or lying. Either way, it was safest for the Memphis community if he at least temporarily locked him up till he figured out what was going on. Taking a couple of his men with him, he hurried to the location of the alleged homicide. Entering the home, in an upstairs room, he found a man lying on the floor. The man wasn't quite dead yet, to steal a line from Monty Python, but he was on his way there. He was bleeding from a gunshot wound to the chest. Still alive, his last words, "I am to blame." Literally, those were his last words. He took responsibility, or "I am to blame." The captain had a dead man with a gunshot wound to his chest. The incoming confessed shooter was a Henry Meyer, a fresco painter who lived in Memphis with his wife and two children, and made a decent living painting frescoes for churches and houses and extensive homes, but mostly churches. The victim was William B. Dunavant, who owned a construction company. Both men happened to be musicians. Meyer played the organ, and Dunavant played guitar. Dunavant had often been seen going to the Myers carrying his guitar, along with a lot of other musicians. Dunavant was a carpenter and a contractor in business with his brother, John. They were working on construction for the upcoming World's Fair when, after hours, he became involved in events resulting in him being fatally shot. His brother, John, and his other brother, Philip, ended up returning the body to Nashville, where they were from, for burial, accompanied by the dead man's wife and child. Dunavant was buried near his father on September 11th of 1886 in a very large family plot purchased by his sister, Franny. His son passed away the next year and was also buried in the same location. Now, if you look for his grave, there's no grave marker for him in particular, but the family plot, there are other of his kinfolk that are buried there. Now, looking at the investigation of the homicide, law enforcement's investigation showed that two men did know each other and were somewhat friends because of their shared musical interests. On that tragic day in 1886, the friend was alone with Meyer's wife in the shooter's home. That might explain something. Henry Meyer didn't hold back anything. He gave a full detailed confession of what had happened and the events leading up to the shooting. Meyer told the police that his skills as a fresco painter were popular and in very high demand. Because of this, he spent a lot of time away from home, painting church walls in Nashville, Jackson, Tennessee, and other locations in Tennessee. as well as other states. He said he had never had any reason to suspect his wife of any type of infidelity while he was away. But one day, while painting frescoes on a wall in a church in Nashville, he received an anonymous letter telling him that some young man had been in his house taking liberties with his wife. Now later, Meyer's wife ended up coming and visiting him when he was working in Jackson, Tennessee. Before she arrived, he received another such letter. This one was more specific. It said that she had been seen late at night in her bedroom, drinking wine and allowing William Donovan to take all kinds of liberty with her. Now, when they did finally get together, Meyer confronted his wife, telling her about the letters when she had arrived in Jacksonville to meet with him. Now, Mrs. Meyer blew off the accusations, telling her husband not to pay attention to such gossip. Somebody was just jealous of their life and the fact that she had a very talented husband who was bringing home the bacon. Now, as you would think he would, Meyer did remain kind of suspicious. After she left, he wrote her a letter saying that the work at the church was going to be more involved than what he had thought, that he needed to spend some more time on the project, and he would not be returning home to Memphis until the following Sunday. Now, the following Wednesday, he ended up taking a train back to Memphis and arriving around 11 p.m., according to his confession. Going to the house, he was able to quietly enter without being seen by anyone. He crashed in a place there, grabbed some sleep where he didn't think he would be found, and was now in a place without being seen by neighbors, family, and especially his wife. On Thursday, after the house got quiet, he moved to the parlor and said he hid inside a wardrobe and waited. Now, in this parlor, or living room, or guest room, whatever, was a sofa that could be opened up into a large bed. That day, he had found that the couch had been made into a bed, and it was that way when he first saw his wife and William Donovan enter the room from his hiding place in the wardrobe and observed them sit down on the edge of the bed. The two of them sat on the bed and talked for a while, again, until Donovan began to inappropriately touch Miss Meyer, according to Mr. Meyer. Now, he also reported that in his statement to police that she tried to push him away, but Donovan got up and closed the parlor door. Returning to the bed, he put his arms around Mrs. Meyer and began taking indecent liberties with her. Donovan pushed her back onto the bed, and that's when husband Henry Meyer said he couldn't stand to watch anymore, jumped up and out of the wardrobe in the furniture closet and drew a pistol, yelling at Donovan to stop, put up his hands. Now, what happens depends on who you believe or what you believe or what you want to believe. Meyer told police he had not intended to kill Donovan. In his formal statement, he wrote that he had only intended to say when he caught Donovan with his wife, quote, "My home is disgraced by you. You took the honor away from it. Take it all now. Only give me enough money to pay the fare for my children to Cairo, and I'll leave it all. If you want the wretched woman, take her. Keep my furniture, organ, and pictures, everything. Only let me take my children away from this town." This is what he planned to say, or at least that's what he said he was going to say. But before he could get out this speech, Donovan, instead of backing down at the point of the pistol, rushed his friend or ex-friend and husband of his lover, and a struggle ensued. And the gun went off. Accidentally, according to Meyer. Dunavant was shot, and at this point, Myers says he simply left, going directly to the police station and turned himself in. Miss Meyer collaborated her husband's statement, said he was justified in what he did. He was protecting her. Going on to say several times to both the police and later in court in the past that Dunavant had tried to take liberties with her, but she had resisted, saying they were both married and what was going on just wasn't the right. Okay. The newspapers quoted her in her court statement as saying, "There are a good many about here who think because I am lively that I am a snap. But they are mistaken." Now, I'm assuming what she's saying in the language of the day, people think she's easy. But then again, she says, they're mistaken. It seemed to be a clear-cut case. Either the gun had gone off accidentally, or it was the justifiable act of a man who had caught the seducer of his wife in flagrant delicto, in what the courts called it.
Scott, the correct pronunciation is in flagrante delicto, meaning caught in the very act of committing a misdeed. What am I going to do with you?
It means Latin for blazing offense, or sometimes simply in blazing. It's a legal term used to indicate that a criminal has been caught in the act of committing an offense. Also, kind of the equivalent of being caught red-handed in the English version. Or in 1880s street slang, the Latin term is often used colloquially as a euphemism for someone being caught in the middle of an inappropriate sexual activity. Self-defense or caught red-handed. Neither situation was likely to convince a Tennessee jury to convict at that time. The state prosecution put a different interpretation on the story in the confession. Not to mention they put some people on the stand that kind of contradicted the good painter's story. The prosecution called it a conspiracy, one between Henry Meyer and his wife to lure William Dunavant into a compromising position and blackmail him. They claimed that when Dunavant refused to pay, Meyer, the lady's husband, shot him. The confession and story of the wife were made up along with the show he was said to have put on for the police. The charges filed against Henry was first-degree murder. Witnesses for the state claimed they saw Meyer and his wife together before the murder. Mrs. Meyer claimed she did not know her husband was in town, but several people testified she had to because she was standing with him. Another witness testified that Carrie Meyer, the defendant's 12-year-old daughter, had gone to Dunavant's shop on the day of the murder with a message that her mother wished Mr. Dunavant to call on her. Three men testified that Meyer had told them he had not meant to kill the man, but only extort money from him for cheating on the victim's own, for seducing his wife. Also, in the spirit of Perry Mason, before Perry Mason was Perry Mason, experiments were performed that the state claimed suggested that Meyer, if he was in the wardrobe, would not have been able to see what all the stuff that he said happened. A point the defense used to show why the confrontation occurred when it did. Newspaper suggested that the judge appeared to favor the prosecution. He did not allow Dunavant's dying words, quote, "I am to blame," to be admitted into evidence. As it could be taken several ways, in other words, you could suggest that the man's dying words can be interpreted in several different ways in several different directions. Another point that today makes no sense if you're familiar with how trials are conducted today. Although he allowed Meyer to read his statement, the judge told the jury it could not be considered to be evidence in the case. In his statement, the state pointed out, also in Meyer's statement, the prosecution pointed out that he said that he'd taken the train home and not told his wife he was going to do so. No one was located who had traveled on that same train that he claimed he had been on that could say they saw the defendant on the train. The ticket man at the station reported he did not sell a ticket to Meyer. The train conductor, who would later check on each ticket holder to make sure they had a ticket, declared that he never saw Meyer on the train either. A local bartender testified to selling a bucket of beer that would be taken over to the Meyer house on the night he was said to have arrived back in town. The empty beer bucket was recovered and located by the police. Unfortunately, the jury found Henry Meyer's account of the murder far more believable than the state's, and he was acquitted. And after his release, Meyer said he planned to take his daughters and move to Germany. It needed to be clarified, of course, whether Mrs. Meyer would be joining him, and I wasn't able to locate any information saying that she did. Mr. Meyer and his daughters didn't show up on the U.S. Census, so I'm assuming they probably did move to Germany, where Meyer apparently had family ties. So the question is, was it defense of a third party? Was it revenge? Was it just plain meanness? Well, a jury made their decision and acquitted the man. We can still make our own decision. What do you think? Think about it. And in the meantime, after you're done thinking about it for a while, you can check out our website, scottlunsfordauthor.com or felonfile.com. Find out a little bit more information about some of our other podcasts and some of my books. And come back later for another episode of Felon File in another 14 days. We'd love to have you come back. And if you have a comment or criticism or information or possibly a suggestion about another podcast, you can drop us a line at the links on the websites or just go ahead and send it straight to felonfile@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you guys. And in the meantime, Victoria, I am going to turn the control board back over to you. You got the controls. And remember, folks, if you have the opportunity to do something good in the world, step up and do it. It's really the right thing to do. And if more people did good things, the world would be a better place. There's no question about that. In the meantime, y'all be safe, be secure, and we'll talk to y'all later. Bye, y'all.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Num books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the webpage to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.